Good morning, good morning. We are dancing in with Soul Mikasa, Manu Dibango. This is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, right here in the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1, with your Friday Speak Up Show. Have we got a treat in store for you.
Good morning, this is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, in the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1 in Burnaby, streaming worldwide at cjsf.ca. Today, our treat is going to be listening to the accomplishments of women crime writers. You haven't heard that much about women crime writers, but our guests are going to let you know how that stands, what a marvelous milestone it is for the awards that they've received recently, and the things that are going to continue it to unfold in Vancouver as a city very dedicated to the arts and very dedicated to writers. I love to ask writers about their three P's, as you know, their purpose, their project, and their passion. So without further ado, I'm going to have our guest introduce themselves to you. Good morning, Frances.
Good morning.
I was just saying, in a city that is so dedicated and excited about literary works, it seems like the event that you were at last night is ushering in the season of programs for writers, workshops for the public. Since you are the first to arrive, tell our guest, our listeners, a little about yourself and the awards you just received and why there is so much excitement about women crime writers.
Well, I can be very happy to introduce myself. Yeah, Frances Peck. And I've actually been a writer my whole life, including for pay. I've been a writer and an editor of other people's writing. But I have to say that most of that writing, in fact, all of it that I did through my career for pay, was not under my own name. It was ghostwriting for clients and authors and so on. So I emerged under my own name with my first novel in 2022, a novel called The Broken Places. And the premise of that one is the big earthquake finally hits Vancouver. It's about a bunch of characters thrown together. And then my current book, my latest book, and the one that we were talking about during last night's panel is Uncontrolled Flight. And that's about the death of a firefighting pilot in the interior of BC and the investigation into what caused the crash and his death. So it's a little bit about me. Our panel last night, which was attended or hosted by me and also Lisa Brito, who'll be joining us soon, and Robin Yateman, a third author who unfortunately can't make it this morning. She has a day job, as we all do. But we were talking last night about a kind of interesting topic, Charlotte. It was about basically being on the edge of different genres. You know, our right. books, thrillers, mysteries, literary fiction, romance, you know, what are they? They blend in elements of all those things.
And so is there a growing awareness among the reading public of this crossover of genres, or how do you think people interpret that? And the bookstores and libraries that are set up that say cooking, history, etc.
Yeah, exactly. Well, see, you kind of nailed it. Like, the bookstores do tend to have those different categories, don't they, labeled in their store, so that somebody walks into a bookstore or a library. Well, actually, libraries less so, I have to say. Let's talk about bookstores for a second. You know, you walk into a bookstore and you want, let's say, a science fiction book. Most bookstores do have a science fiction section, and they often mix it with fantasy. Or you walk in and you want a mystery, you know, a whodunit or something like that. There's often a mystery section. And you can see why. Like, it is helpful to readers who are looking for a particular kind of read to be able to go directly to those shelves and find the kind of thing that they want. But the fact is that a lot of fiction out there, including our fiction, it doesn't neatly fit into one of those categories. And we You asked, is there a growing awareness with the reading public? I would tend to say, no, not really. I don't know that readers pay a lot of attention to genre and where a book fits, other than there are some, as I say, who just always want a mystery, or they always want a romance, or they always want a sci-fi. Where there's a lot of attention to genre is among writers and in the whole publishing machine, basically, if I can put it that way, because publishers, publicists, book marketers, etc., they need to know where to put your book.
Where does it go? Right. What kind of sign do we put over it?
Exactly. And for them, it's a business decision, right? If is this book a thriller? Well, if so, we're going to market it like a thriller. We're going to try to tap into the audience for thrillers. We're going to give it a cover that makes it look like a thriller, et cetera, et cetera. It just I think maybe streamlines their process a little bit.
Mentoring younger people, well, I'm an old person that needs some mentors, but in mentoring, how do you work with helping young writers or new writers avoid the fear that they have about crossing genres, or where it's been so much put into their head in an English class or something? This has to be whatever, if it's fiction, or this has to be love. How do you see the role of a mentor in helping new writers feel not feel guilty about it? Splitting or mixing genres.
Yeah, good question. I mean, it was interesting. When the three of us sat down last night to talk about this, one of the questions that came up was, when you, the author, sat down to write your novel, were you conscious of genre? Did you sit down and think, I want to write a romance, or I want to write a satire, or I want to write a thriller, whatever the case may be? And our answers across the board were no, we didn't think about genre. We just sat down to write the book that was in us that needed to come out. And the questions about what genre does it fit into came up much later, after the book was written. And if I am dealing with younger writers or emerging writers, of course, emerging writers aren't always young. Lots of
Right.
people like me, I was already in my 50s when I published my first novel. So, but somebody who's on the cusp of publishing, or maybe they've just written a manuscript and they're wondering about where does it fit and so on. If they've already written the book, my advice to them would be to start thinking about genre. Yes, because a publisher, well, an agent and or a publisher will always ask a writer for what are called comparables. They'll say, what are some comparable books in the world out there, ideally that are selling well, that are like your book? And the minute they ask that question, now you're in a corner, aren't you? Because now you've got to think, okay, so what books are kind of like my book? And you instantly start looking on the shelves out there to see what matches. And you do inevitably have to think about genre then. However, if a writer is at an earlier stage where they're still writing, they don't have a finished manuscript yet, my advice is always just follow the story. Write the story that is most authentic to you, that needs to be told, follow your art, really. And don't be thinking about questions of genre at that early stage. Now, I'd have to jump in and add one thing, and that is that there certainly are writers out there who are writing in a very specific genre. I mean, let's think about, writers who write romance novels, or who are writing a science fiction novel, or are writing a whodunit mystery. They can tell you from the get-go, hey, this is my genre. I'm going to write a book that fits that genre because this is the genre I'm comfortable in, that I love, where my audience is, et cetera, et cetera. So we don't want to forget those folks who, really have a niche carved out for themselves. But the rest of us who are, like a bunch of popcorn in a bowl, sort of, like we're just, we have all elements of all kinds of different genres in our books. I don't think we should be thinking too much about it during the creation stage. I mean, do you, if you don't mind a question back, when you read a book, Are you really conscious of the genre that the book is in? Like, do you go looking for that?
Well, sometimes when I'm looking for a book, I have a particular feeling. So I might be feeling for a book that feels has spirituality, or I might be feeling like for a movie, I really need to see something funny. I need to read something funny. So I might look. But other times, I've spent hours just browsing around bookstores for the cover or something that I've read, like reading that, there were going to be three authors. Well, there are few places having panels. Well, then I'm curious because I want to see, what their product is. I want to hear their passion for it. Then I get excited because the passion or excitement that an author has about their work makes me think, oh, that might be good. So I don't go in just, I mean, when I was in school, go in just to buy nutrition or history books, but now I'm show me something.
Yeah.
But I did spend one day, there was something I was looking for and I could not find. They couldn't tell me what category to look in because it was one of those things that I think crossed genres and they were not very helpful. And the little signs, they said, well, it might be in religion, it might be in history, or it might be in whatever.
Charlotte, from what you said, I was going to throw in there something that might interest you. At Iron Dog Books in East Van, where our event was held last evening, they have a category that I don't think I've ever seen in a bookstore before. They have a section of their shelves labeled feel good books. And I was thinking, you know what you said, I get in that frame of mind sometimes because I do tend to read a lot of serious fiction, and sometimes it's dark and tragic, and frankly, it can be kind of depressing. And I'll get to a point where I think, I just want to read something that's going to make me feel good, that'll make me laugh or bring me joy. And I loved that they had that as a category.
Yes, I mean, that's right, because so much is telling people about personal care, feel good about yourself. So typically that would have gone maybe in medicine or it might have gone in psychology rather than feel good book.
Yeah, and I think some of the books they have in that category are humorous books or maybe romantic comedies, that kind of thing, like those sorts of stories, a little on the lighter side.
I was going to ask you, have they created I know there's a movie genre called rom-com, but is there a book genre called rom-com?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely there is.
Let's stop a second and say good morning, Lisa. Welcome.
Good morning. Nice to
Yeah.
meet you.
Yes, we were just talking about this thing of genre and the difference in writing the book that you are, that's speaking to you, and writing a book to fit a genre. So maybe you could introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little about you.
Yeah, so I'm Lisa Brito. I'm a debut author. My debut novel is Adrift, which is kind of a suspenseful mystery set in the near future about a woman who wakes up on a sailboat in Haida Gwaii with no memory of who she is or how she got there. And it follows her on her journey as she tries to unpack what happened and kind of how you exist in the world without any memories of who you are.
That sounds interesting. I keep having dreams about Haida Gwaii.
It's a
Maybe that
magical
would happen to
place.
me. What does your you were talking also about genres, and what advice do you give someone who's starting off regarding the existing genres?
Yeah, it's tricky. When I wrote Adrift, I definitely wasn't thinking about that. There was a story that I wanted to tell, and I was kind of following it where it took me, and it was set in the near future, so a bit of speculative kind of sci-fi, but really with a mystery at its core, so a bit of mystery and suspense. And it wasn't until I started on the publishing journey that suddenly this question of genre and how to categorize it came up. And so I think there's a couple paths you can go. One is just to tell the story that's drawing at you that you're really passionate about and then worry about the rest later, or to study the genre categorizations at the outset and know what they are, not necessarily to fit into a box, but just to have that awareness, which can either smooth your path later or just so you know what you're navigating as you go. It was a bit
Right.
of a learning journey for me after the fact. Which maybe it would have been helpful to have that knowledge just about kind of the standards for various genre categories, because some are quite specific.
Well, Lisa, you and Francis are on the same point about that. And I think listeners would be happy to know because people sometimes get discouraged by their high school or college English teacher who says, you have to do this, you have to stay within these boundaries. And so I think hearing people who have published say, no, write what's in your heart, write the story that's talking to you.
Yeah. I think you have to have fun with what you're doing and find the joy and the enjoyment. And if you don't, then
It's a
why are you
struggle.
doing it? Yeah, it's a struggle. Yeah. So find a path where you can enjoy it. And if fitting into a, a box or a template doesn't do that, I think you can have, be really creative within, the standard confines of a genre. Like mystery genres, one where they have quite specific expectations for kind of how you kind of move through the story. And then it's about finding the creativity within that template, which can be a fun exercise as well. So there's joy to be had in multiple paths. You just got to find the one that works for you, right?
Yeah, the other thing is too, I think that if a writer sits down to write a book and it's if they're trying too hard to fit themselves into a genre where maybe it's not a comfortable fit, the reader is going to sense that too. It's going to show in the manuscript that their voice is going to sound inauthentic, or the story might seem forced, or the characters might seem molded to fit the story. And readers are very intuitive and perceptive, and they know when things are false in a story, and they don't like that. Readers are always, whatever they're reading, they're craving something authentic, something that feels authentic and true. And the writers out there who intentionally write in a genre like sci-fi or mystery or romance and who are really good at it, it's because they feel a call toward that genre and they can be their authentic, they can speak their authentic voices through that genre.
Speaking of authentic voices, a question I like to ask people, I'll ask each of you individually, what do you see as your purpose in life? Do you, how do you, what would be your answer to what's your purpose?
Wow, I feel like I want to have maybe about 12 sessions of therapy or something before I could answer that question, Charlotte. That's a big one. I personally don't think a lot about my purpose in life. I don't think. I think about things like, I guess when I'm writing, and I think that's what you're probably referring to mostly. When I'm writing, I feel like I have two purposes. So one purpose is to satisfy something artistic within myself. And I will confess to a certain amount of selfishness when I think any writer feels this. I mean, a writer's job is the most boring thing you can imagine. Like, that's why nobody films a writer at work, because you're just going to see a person sitting in front of a screen or possibly having a long walk and daydreaming. That's when all the writing takes place. So if you're going to do that, if you're going to live a life where it's just you and the page a lot of the time, you've got to be doing it to satisfy something inside yourself. So that's the first thing. I guess I have what, an imagination or a sense of creativity or some artistic side that needs to be expressed. But then I find once I've written and I'm working on the piece, like I'm revising it, which you have to do with a reader in mind. Like, the minute you go back to try to make it a better book, you're thinking about your readers. At that point, I don't think this is my purpose, but I am always extremely mindful of empathy. And thus far, everything I've written, I've tried to enter into the lives and heads of characters who are very different from me, although there are always some similarities. But I try to think, what makes them tick? Why are they the way they are? Why do they behave the way they do? Why are they that way? The psychology of people fascinates me. And I think the more that we all can explore that, what's going on inside the heads of our fellow humans, the greater are our chances of trying to understand the humans, especially those who are different from us, and feeling that we are all connected. I mean, that I think that notion of empathy is a pretty strong one for me.
I think that's a very important for people who are writing or thinking about writing. that you have to spend some time getting into the head of the character, not just the person that's the main character, but how do the neighbors or work co-workers, how do other people fit and how do they think? Now, in doing that, have you taken any particular psychology courses, or is that just something intuitively that comes from you, the need to get inside the heads of your characters?
Well, my background, my education is all in English literature, but when you are raised on a steady diet of writing, you do read about so many different people and characters that I do think you tap into their psychology a little bit. I interviewed an awful lot of people when I was a for-pay writer. Writing freelance gigs, you often end up interviewing people a lot. And I had other there are other aspects of my career. I was an investigator for a time of complaints of harassment in the workplace, which I got into as a writer, but ended up being trained up as an investigator. And you end up having to do a lot of layperson psychology when you're doing that kind of a job, kind of parsing out why did someone do what they did and whatnot. So I think that my interest is probably more, from those streams than anything.
So, Lisa, what do you see as do you see yourself as having a particular purpose? You or your work or
Yeah, I had time. Well, Francis was answering to think about that big question. I feel like my overarching answer is kind of a desire to leave the world better than I found it or than I entered into it, and finding ways to do that. And so in my professional life, I'm lucky that I get to work in the area of sustainability. So I come to work every day and kind of get a chance to feel like I have that chance to try and make improvements, working, on climate change policy. So that's really satisfying. And it turned out that that kind of bled into my fiction as well, that like with Adrift, there's a layer of kind of it takes place against this backdrop of climate change. And it's not about that. It's more that that's kind of the environment in which it takes place because it's set in the near future. And I wanted to try and engage people in conversations about climate change without it being like it is in my professional world, where it's overwhelming and people often get paralyzed with grief and just that sense of overwhelm. I wanted to put it into like kind of embed it into a vehicle of entertainment so that people could have fun and enjoy themselves in the reading process like they do with, a novel, but still come away with some, hopefully some thoughts or new ideas about the issues that we're grappling with. And then maybe that translates into real life conversations. I've had some great book club conversations that veer into the realm of like actual climate change actions, which is exactly what I had hoped for, that it would be an entertaining process, an entertaining read, and then you would meet with your friends and have conversations about ideas that came up as just part of the novel. So, yeah, I think that idea of how can we spark conversations, and part of it, there's an element in Adrift that's about climate migration, this question of people who are forced to leave where they live because of climate change impacts. And, if how's Canada going to respond to that if people want to relocate to Canada because it's maybe not as impacted as immediately. And are we having those conversations, or are we going to wait until it's a crisis and then respond in like a not humane way? And so that idea of how can we empathize with people and create that, yeah, that preparatory conversation before it's a crisis on our doorstep and we just have a really knee-jerk reaction that tends to be cruel.
Yeah, I'm sure as both of you know, the crisis now going through the Caribbean with not just one island, but multiple islands being wiped out, it brings to a head that we need to have decent conversations about climate control. I think writers speaking to people, or that kind of message that's within both of your books, those are things that can help before the lion is at the door. But now, what role do you think writers, people in the literary arts will have in helping with both the emotional as well as the business talks that we're going to need to be done immediately with so much devastation?
I think it's huge for all arts to reflect back the crises that are happening in our lifetime and the ones that are coming, right? It's to make sure that we're confronting the reality that's ahead of us and trying to prepare people for it and to prepare for the possible futures, to imagine out what are the different scenarios that are coming if we make the following choices. So I think fiction is a great opportunity, but all arts, and it's interesting in that there's a fantastic author, Amitav Ghosh, who wrote The Great Derangement, and he talks about how, this is a few years ago now, but he talks about how the arts world, literature in particular, hadn't been grappling with climate change in fiction. And anyone who did got kind of shelved over in the science fiction genre. And it was immediately discounted as not serious literature because it was set in the future and talking about extreme weather events. And somehow that was immediately science fiction. And he was really critiquing that and the need for the literary arts to actually grapple with this reality that's in front of us now. And it was a failure of the arts to shy away from it. And I think that's shifted. I think there are more literary arts that are delving into climate. But yeah, my sense is that it's one tool among many to make sure these ideas that are raised in the public consciousness so that they can engage in the real world by talking to their politicians and pressuring for the actions that we need to take and making sure we're setting ourselves on a better course. We're helping care for the communities that are impacted, especially because Canada is responsible for a lot of the emissions, but the impacts are being felt by other countries like the Caribbean and who are feeling more and more extreme weather events and hurricanes, right? So kind of unpacking what our responsibility is and where we can help for the communities, even external to Canada, that are impacted.
Oh, Francis, what do you think about this? Now it brings to a head all of these questions or debates about climate change or the effects or things, the same things that were going to be 5 years out that are right now devastating lives. What role or how do you see the role or skills of a writer in dealing with this crisis?
Well, I certainly agree with Lisa. You know, fiction in particular, which is what both of us write, has always been, in some ways, a better vehicle for conveying ideas to people than other forms of writing. Because when we're reading story, we're absorbed in what we're reading in a different way from when we're just reading information. You know, when we're reading for informational purposes, most of us anyway skim, you know, we read quickly. We often read with, you know, inside a kind of echo chamber. We're looking for the ideas that mirror the ideas and opinions that we already hold. And when we encounter challenging ideas and opinions, we're more likely to discount them or refute them mentally. When we encounter story, though, and there's all this brain science now that shows how readers respond to story, that their brains fire in a way, in such a way, as if they were actually doing the actions that they're reading about in the story. That's how much story engages us as readers. And if we can fall into a story and enter the worlds and minds of the characters in the story who are going through, let's say, a climate change event or emergency or situation or something, we as readers are more likely to experience the thoughts, feelings, decisions of those characters than if we were just reading about this in an informational way. And, you know, I guess it does go back a little bit to what I was saying about empathy. A lot of writers make the, you know, make a pretty explicit connection between what they write if they're writing fiction and the notion of empathy, because story has that power. It has that power to bring readers inside a world. And while they're in that world, they can be experiencing life through the eyes and through the minds of the characters in the story. So story has a lot of power to help people explore their thoughts and maybe expand their thoughts, you know, and maybe entertain some ideas that are different to them. You know, one thing I will say, my novel, unlike Lisa's, it doesn't deal with climate change. However, there is wildfire as a background to my novel. You know, it's about the crash of a firefighting pilot. And one of the main characters in the book is an aerial firefighter. That's what he does for a living. And so there's certainly description of wildfire in the book. But interestingly, I drafted this novel way back in 2012, 2013, so over a decade ago now. And at the time, the most devastating wildfire that we in British Columbia had experienced was the 2003 wildfire that threatened Kelowna, the city of Kelowna and surrounding area. It started in Okanagan Mountain Provincial Park by lightning and then spread. And it was all over the news at that time. And it claimed more property and was responsible for more property damage and so on than any other wildfire in BC history at that time. I was so struck when the book came out last fall on the heels of the 2023 wildfire season, which was record-breaking in a huge way in British Columbia. I was so struck by how that 2003 wildfire, which had seemed so huge, and the 2003 wildfire season, which had just astonished all of us in British Columbia, it had been far eclipsed by the season of 2023. I mean, the damage, the number of hectares burnt was multiples more last year. And it was really sobering just to reflect on that, because here we are, it's happening. And there's no question our fiction is going to increasingly represent that happening.
What about, as you say, people are astounded by books that they missed. You know, we might have missed it in 2010, but now it's 2024. Things that an author might have been seeding out either through a story or through a factual book. How do you think people feel about not taking action sooner? Because I'm thinking, you know, looking at the Caribbean, each of these places, there's so many people vacation there. At the same time, the people were enjoying the lushness and lavishness of being entertained, there were people talking about climate change and how the temperature of the water in the Atlantic was going to be a problem. Do you think people might go back to looking at that book or asking themselves more of, you know, what can I do or what should I have done?
I think we're gonna have lots of regrets as we move into the kind of climate impacted future, and especially younger folks wondering why, you know, the generation in power at the time didn't do more. And I think it's a puzzling kind of human response to we don't take account for the cost of inaction. So we see the cost of doing a thing, but we're not very good at assessing the cost of not doing the action. So, you know, switching to renewable energy and the technology transfer required for that has a cost. But not doing it and continuing to burn fossil fuels also has a cost. And we're just not very good at that accounting. And especially because we don't account for impacts to the environment, we just view that as kind of an economic sense. It's just there for us as a resource rather than something that's keeping us alive and necessary to all of our well-being. And so I think there's that fundamental barrier. And if we start now to experience, as it's more common, I mean, people in the city of Vancouver are very, very connected to wildfires now because the air quality in Vancouver has been impacted in several years in a really distressing way. And so that's something that's much more front of mind for people, which I think does make it easier to take actions to try and reduce the risk of wildfire, to, you know, improve air quality, because it's something everyone has personally experienced. So I think in a sad way, the fact that we're all having these personal experiences with various climate related events and emergencies, it's hopefully going to make it easier to take steps so that hopefully we have fewer regrets. It's that personal, people need to have that personal visceral experience, unfortunately, to see the threats that scientists can flag as a real thing, a real danger that needs and warrants real action to try and prevent or mitigate.
Yeah, I think writers also flag. I'm going to ask you a few more questions about that. But right now I want to say, this is CJSF Radio 90.1 in Burnaby, streaming worldwide at cjsfc.ca. I'm Charlotte Farrell, your own sister C, here in this place to be. And our show is called Saluau. It stands for My Guest and I Speak Up, so you can listen up and act upon what you've heard. That takes me into a question to my guests. My guests today are Frances Peck and Lisa Boudreau-Bedeau. Causes that you've been involved in, how do you see the role or function of writers in causes? Well, even Another question before that, because you mentioned being able to talk without hitting each other. So much of the talks that have happened around women's rights, abortion, climate, people are yelling at each other, and fights have broken out in some places. So the process that you go through, are you talking about what parts of the process of writing do you think can help make people more able to civilly discuss issues with each other?
I think I'm going back in my mind, Charlotte, to when we started talking, and I was mentioning that just for myself, if I sit down to write something, what I'm writing is it's got to come from an authentic place in me, I guess. And thus far, I haven't sat down to write with a cause in mind per se. Like I don't really see myself as a writer who is probably driven by causes in terms of what I write. And yet, because I'm a human in the world and surrounded by society, as the story is taking shape, I find that, of course, certain societal issues find their way into the story. And and then, of course, as I step back from what I've written and see, oh, there's a, you know, the theme of class is treated. I mean, there's one example that's a theme that I cover in both of my books, probably a little bit more so in my first novel, The Broken Places, from a couple of years ago. That deals a lot with class, economic class, and the haves and the have-nots. When the great earthquake hits Vancouver and some characters are thrown together, as happens in that novel, they're characters from really different backgrounds and they have different levels of wealth and different levels of entitlement. And the question that I explore is how do they live together? You know, what are the conflicts and tensions that simmer because they've been thrown together by circumstances? And in that world of devastation where there's no power, there are no services, you have to shelter in place, your cell phone doesn't work, your landline doesn't even work, like everything is down. Who is actually able to manage that situation? And it isn't necessarily the people who have all the power in the pre-earthquake world, you know, the people who have more common sense knowledge, the more working class folks are the ones who come to the forefront when we're in that position of catastrophe. So that I just give that as an example. Like there's an example of something that, you know, emerged in that novel. I have like a lot of gay people in my family and in my circles of friends. And so, again, in the broken places, there's a couple that's gay, but they don't talk about that as an issue, if you know what I mean. They just are like they're just two men who happen to live together and be long-term partners and have relationship struggles. But I do hope when readers read characters like that, that it helps, I guess, to normalize those characters for them. You know, like I guess if a reader, well, I can't imagine a reader picking up my book and being homophobic. I mean, but maybe let's say they were. I guess I would like to think that if they just read about a couple who happen to be gay, that it might make them realize, like, hello, they're just people like the rest of us. And
Right.
who we go to bed with at night is irrelevant
Not
to
anybody's
anything.
business.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess that's all to say that when it comes to causes, to get back to your question, I think they're maybe embedded in my fiction because they're part of the society that I'm trying to write about, but I don't sit down to write motivated by the cause. I'm very character motivated. Usually what starts me off on a story is a person. It's the character, and then we go from there.
I have to flag that because in Frances's more recent novel, Uncontrolled Flight, one of the main characters is a woman working in a male-dominated industry as a flight crash investigator. And my background is engineering, and I was the first woman engineer at the company that I worked for. And that really resonated with me, the complexities of just her navigating that space, just trying to do her job, but having this added layer of kind of complexity to things because it's a traditionally male-dominated space. And so I think That really resonates with me, Frances, what you're saying about how it's the society we live in and kind of exploring aspects of that where it might be, yeah, just challenges that people face in an environment because they're in a minority or they're not, yeah, then this the additional layer of struggles they might have as a result of that. But it's not about that. That's just layered in throughout the story in a really beautiful way.
Well, and it's very much the same with your book Adrift as well, because climate change is there. I mean, it's inescapable because it shapes the world that the story takes place in. But it's not a story about climate change. It's a story about this character who has lost her identity and that whole question, who is she? And is the who she is determined by her past and the memories which she doesn't have, or is there something essential about her in the present that makes her who she is? And that whole search for identity I found really compelling in the book. And that really it in many ways doesn't even seem to have much to do with the climate change background. So yeah, your cli the climate change is part of the society, the overall world in which the story takes place.
Yeah, I think the climate change as well. A person today, after I think I watched several different newscasts last night, but when they said the power is out, Grenada, that there's nothing, there's no building standing here, that a person on this side reading a book like that, could, because it seems unimaginable. But now you have a character so that that character can help somebody who's really picturing this is what that person that they're talking about in the newscast, this is what they're going through. And so I think that while you said you're not associated with any particular causes, I know Iron Dog Books has quite frequently had readers or presentations around social justice or community issues. Could you tell us a little bit about the process? Were you producers of the program? That was, can you tell a little bit about that process and also about Iron Dog because they are the thing about Iron and a dog. I think the dog the dog could either be biting somebody or the dog is standing in front of this iron door saying, "Not here, not on my watch." So tell us a little about your events and that social interaction.
Yeah, so we, I think the origin of the talk that we did was Frances and I meeting and kind of this interesting just dynamic about how our book, both our books, got tagged through just kind of the marketing processes, thrillers, and us kind of questioning, are they thrillers, and what does it mean to be a thriller, and what does it mean when you categorize books in this way, and how books are very complicated stories that touch and dive into various kind of topics and may, might pull on threads of multiple genre categories. And so it was just this interesting kind of process going from a creative product to a more commercial product that's being sold and has to fit on a shelf and the decisions that are made about which shelf it fits on. And we thought this might be of interest to other writers and readers and just who kind of question this whole categorization of our world when stories are complex things, people are complex things, and categorization helps and limits us. And there's just something really interesting there that we were both really intrigued by. And reaching out to Iron Dog Books, I think they've been a great supporter of Adrift, and I think Frances's two books as well. And just personally, as an ethos, the fact that they're an Indigenous-owned bookstore is, I think, a beautiful thing in trying to support those Indigenous-owned businesses in our community is huge, and wanting to see them succeed and thrive, and it's been really exciting to see them grow in their storefront. And yeah, they were really open to hosting us, and I think it was this idea of kind of writers and readers coming together for conversations, not just being about readers. So it's a bit of a different thing for them to do that. And I think because our books were all about complex humans, quite character driven. And so they did, in all their different ways, touch on various aspects of just what it means to be a messy human navigating this world that we're in. I think that touched on the kind of story and conversations that Iron Dog is looking to have in their space. I think they're just great supporters of local writers as well. So, like, yeah, hugely thankful for them providing the space and hosting us. It was very generous of them.
Yeah, Iron Dog says on their website, In their About Us section, they say bookstores are more than just retail businesses.
Yes.
They are centers of community engagement and discourse. And they really, I think, embody that statement. And not everybody knows that they began as a mobile bookstore. They began as a book truck, in fact, kind of
Yes.
like a bookmobile. And, and talk about community engagement. They were actually going into communities to bring the books to those people who were not served by an independent bookstore. And they would show up at festivals and things like that, bringing books to the people instead of just sitting back and waiting for people to come to the books. So kudos to them for doing that. They did, in due course, decide to go with a bricks and mortar bookstore, which is what they have now. But I always think that's pretty amazing that that was their first model for the business is, get a lot of great books together, include a lot of Indigenous books, Indigenous authored, and books about Indigenous topics and other topics and writers who are going to basically stimulate discourse in the community, and then take that stuff to the community.
Yes, I had the pleasure of being on that truck, discovering it was one of the music festivals that was happening maybe 2017, before COVID. And it was just a joy watching, they had a space where some little kids were sitting down. They had a space where you could just ask questions. They asked if you had water. They weren't pushing you to buy stuff, come in and experience it. If you see something that you like, you could buy it. And so I thought this is really a wonderful community experience that they now, I think there's a walking tour, book walking tour, and they're in the center and they show where people can go and they find books that are really around community development, strength of development, because the 312 Main building is in that little illustration they have of a kind of a pathway that connects the bookstores or businesses that are more social, have a greater social consciousness. Now, again, with the business of writing, because we said sometimes the problem people have, I'm a writer, I've published two books of poetry. I published through Arthur House, which is next to self-publishing because they don't give you any marketing assistance. But I think the people that have street festivals, like the All Day where Main Street is closed or different places are closed, it gives people an opportunity to come out and meet the people behind the counters, get a chance, musicians, writers have a chance to not just be on the stage, do their thing and go, but are down mixing among people. What do you think of what is involved in the business of doing it? When you have to send out letters, can you walk us through a little bit of the process of what an independent writer goes through, either trying to get a publisher or to get their books on the market? Because there are all these things that are popping up on my phone or YouTube every day. Be a writer, write a book in 30 days, take our course, and it's not particularly helpful. So can you talk a little bit about that process of, where you have to get into the business of marketing your book?
Well, I can kick that off, and then maybe Lisa, you'd like to add a few things, because it's a huge topic you're asking about there, Charlotte. There's so much to say. But, the first thing that a writer has to think about is whether they want, I would say the first thing is that they have to decide if they want to pursue traditional publishing. So, do they want to be published by a publisher? That which Lisa and I have done, and Robin Yateman, who was on our panel last night, has done too. Or do they want to self-publish their work? Or do they want to be somewhere in between? Because there are any number of hybrid publishers who have some aspects of traditional publishers, but some aspects of self-publishing as well. So that's a big decision to make. And then what you do, that the business path that you follow then depends on which direction you're going in. So, because I write literary fiction first and foremost, when the time came for me to think about publishing, I really did not think about self-publishing. And there was just a practical reason for that. Literary, self-published literary fiction does not do well, it doesn't get recognized. Readers of literary fiction don't tend to go to Amazon, let's say, to discover their latest reads, they discover the books that they want to read through different methods that are better served by a traditional publisher. So I was had it pretty firmly in mind that I wanted to try to get published by a traditional publisher. And so I did get an agent quite early on. And there's a long twisted story. I mean, as I mentioned to you, Uncontrolled Flight, my current novel, I wrote that back in 2012, 2013, and it was only published in 2023. That's a decade in between, right? And all I can say about that decade to synthesize it all is that getting published by a traditional publisher, you have to think of it as being a war of attrition. Basically, it's the person or people who are left standing who are likely to get published eventually. I mean, there are definitely exceptions. There are writers who get published right out of the gate and they make a name for themselves and they do well with their book and then they're off to the races. You know, there goes there begins their career as a writer. But for most of us toiling away in the trenches, if I can continue the warfare metaphor, we get shot at again and again and again and again. We hear no, no, no. We hear, I loved it, but I'm not going to publish it. This was a great book, but we're not publishing it. We couldn't put the book down, but we're not going to pick it up.
Oh, yes.
You know, and it just goes on and on. And your business model, I think, if you're going to go that route, has to involve a lot of armor. You have to just be willing to feel the feelings of rejection. Sulk for an hour or a day or a week and pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and do it all over again. You just have to keep at it. And if you're still standing 10 years later, you're going to hit the publisher who says, I love your book and I'm going to publish it.
Well, let's just let our listeners know again your name, your website, how to get in touch with you, where they can buy your books.
Sure. Well, I'm Frances Peck. And my website is francispeck.com, so fairly easy to remember. And my first novel was called is called The Broken Places. It was named a best book of 2022 by the Globe and Mail. I was really happy about that. And it was also shortlisted for the Rakuten Kobo Emerging Writer Prize too. So that's the first book, The Broken Places. And my new novel is called Uncontrolled Flight. And both of those books are available anywhere that you like to buy your books, everywhere from independent booksellers, be they bricks and mortar or be they online booksellers, right on through to the big guys, Indigo, Barnes and Noble, if you're in the United States. Amazon and so forth. So very easy to order. And they're available in both print book and ebook form, not audiobook, I should
Okay.
clarify, because people often wonder about that.
Yes, and the library now has a little cart with audiobooks on it. And they say there's been a 49% increase in people getting audiobooks or buying audiobooks.
Yeah, they're super popular. And yes, for the libraries too. And thank you for mentioning libraries because I should also say, I mean, it's not just about buying a book, right? There are lots of people who don't want to or can't afford to buy a book. And I'm delighted the local libraries all through the Lower Mainland, all through British Columbia, have been really good about having both of my novels there to borrow. So your listeners will probably be able to track down my books through their local libraries too.
Yes, I put in a plug as well for Vancouver Public Library and the library system because they have, I forgot, I was in the library for one thing, but I saw this little cart and the cart was there saying, check out audiobooks or check out, they specifically mentioned audiobooks, but they also, during the book week last year, they had an example of how you could get, if you were an author and you wanted to get your book in the public library system, they had someone there with the forms. They said, we have the forms today, they could make an appointment. And I thought, that's really wonderful that the library would say, you know, here we are. We can, you know, we can help you as a self-published author. And so I was visiting the There were so many things. It was Book Vancouver. There were a lot of right events, but this particular event, it was just so pleasant, you know, that you could go there. When people said it's a simple form, it wasn't 20 pages you had to download and, you know, sing a song to get put in. So I really, you know, applaud the, how they are available to authors to help them get their books and their audiobooks in the public library system.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Most libraries have a form that readers can also suggest books that the library purchased to add to their collection. So if you're ever in love with a book and want your library to have a copy, if you search their website, often there's a form that you can fill out. Just make that suggestion. That's lovely.
Will either or both of you be hosting any other events over the summer?
I think I'm not, but Francis, do you have something coming up?
I am going to be in the lineup for Word Vancouver, which you know, you were speaking about festivals earlier in our conversation, and that's an annual festival that celebrates books and writing and reading and readers and so on. It has an online component. Word Vancouver does, like they have a number of events that run online in the lead up to the one day event, which is on Saturday, September the 28th. So not exactly summer, but that's probably the next big event that I have coming up. I'm going to be on a panel as part of Word Vancouver,
And that's the
and
Word Festival or Word Fan.
Word Vancouver. Used to be way back in the day, it used to be called Word on the Street, but then they renamed themselves. That's going back a ways. So yeah, it's called Word Vancouver. And the it's very easy to find online, you know, just look up Word Vancouver. And they're the in-person festival on the 28th of September will all be held at UBC Robson Square. So that downtown Robson Square campus of UBC. So super accessible if you're, you know, on foot or using transit or anything like that. And Lisa, your stuff is pretty easy to get. Your book is easy to get hold of, I think, right? Adrift. I see it everywhere. Every time I go
Oh,
into a
that's good to
bookstore,
hear.
there's Adrift. It just is keeps going and going. It's a popular book.
That's awesome to hear. Yeah, so I'm Lisa Brito. You can find me online. My website is lisabrito.com, and my last name, since no one can spell it, is Brideau. So lisabrito.com. Yeah, and I'm lucky Adrift's available anywhere you buy books, at ebook, and I'm lucky that there is an audiobook format. So for folks who like their audiobooks, it is available that way. And same, local libraries have been fantastic. So it's pretty reliably available in libraries, which is wonderful. And I'll throw in a plug that I love doing book club conversations. So if anyone's book club reads Adrift and wants to reach out and schedule if your local visit or a Zoom drop-in, I love. My book is full of mysteries, and so when I'm talking to people who haven't read it, there's a lot I can't say because I don't want to spoil the experience of reading it. And I love book clubs because there's no risk of spoilers. They've read it, we can get into all the details. And it's a lot of fun. So yeah, feel free to reach out if your book club is interested and wants to read and have me drop by.
And ditto for me. I'm like you, Lisa. I love doing book clubs. And our books are similar in that respect, that there are a lot of secrets that get re gradually revealed and layers that get peeled back. And it's so nice to be able to talk about the ending, you know, and so on.
And I think the great thing, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned book clubs because I know churches, different types of groups, parenting groups, a lot of people form them and they talk a lot about the book. I was listening at a service, the end of an audio, what do you call it? Online church. And one of the things was coming up was the book club thing. And the pastor said, you know, I hadn't read a book lately, but I went to this thing and it was so good. Each week we moved ahead. And so, you know, he re recommended it as one of the things people might do as a positive, just self-care, just a positive enjoy life activity.
It's a good way to connect with people.
So speaking of enjoying life, I've really enjoyed this conversation with you, Francis and Lisa. I wish you every success in your book. And from just the things you've said, our listeners will probably say, hey, let's check out those two books. And to know that you can get it at anywhere, the books are sold. Thank you to my listeners for being with us from 10 on Friday mornings. You know what we say? We speak up. My guest and I speak up so you can listen up and act upon what you have heard. When people ask me what time it is, though, you know, I always say it's love time, poem time. Love time.